Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Diller Teen Tikkun Olam Awards. Help shine a light on the next generation of inspiring young Jewish leaders. Each year, the Diller Teen Tikkun Olam Awards recognize 15 extraordinary Jewish teenagers from across the United States with an award of $36,000 to honor their initiatives to help change the world. You can nominate a teen today, or they can apply directly by January 7th. Visit www.dillerteenawards.org/unbound to learn more. That's www.dillerteenawards.org/unbound. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 298, Judaism, Inconveniently Itself. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we are thrilled to welcome our guest today, who is another new entrant into the world of Jewish podcasting, although that's not her primary claim to fame. Our guest today is Ezra Furman. Her primary claim to fame is as a musician, singer, songwriter, and basically rock star. As a recording artist, Ezra Furman has recently come to prominence because her music is featured as the soundtrack of the Netflix TV show Sex Education. Ezra Furman has recorded a number of other albums, including the most recent 12 Nudes in 2019 and also 2018's Transangelic Exodus, which has been described as a narrative-driven rock opera of sorts, a queer outlaw saga, which was listed on some of 2018's Best Album of the Year lists. Ezra Furman is an author who has written a book on Lou Reed's album Transformer as part of the 33 and a Third series of books. But what we're most excited about is that Ezra Furman has recently become a podcaster. Her podcast, Two Queers, Four Questions, co-hosted with Agnes Berinsky, is, quote, a free-spirited series of conversations where two Jewish trans artists ask four new questions about each major Jewish holiday with the aim of uncovering and recovering Judaism's punk, queer, countercultural potential. I can attest that it's a very thought-provoking way into the Jewish holidays and really a good way to prepare for each one of them. We're super excited to have this conversation. So Ezra Furman, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
I'm so honored to be here. Love this podcast. I think it's a great digital document of the Judaism of our times. Thanks for making it.
Thank you. Well, so I wanted to start by just getting a little bit of the story of how, you know, so many of our listeners are like this, you know, a Jewish kid in the suburbs who, you know, maybe went to a day school, maybe didn't. And how did they go from there to becoming a rock star? Like, how did that happen in your own story?
I'm as surprised as anyone. It wasn't the plan. I had occasional, like, rock star-y dreams as a kid, but I was like, that's not possible. It wasn't like an option of one of the things you could be. It seemed like an impossible thing. So I thought my little guitar playing and songwriting habit was just gonna be a hobby that wasn't gonna become anything. But it did start with a bar mitzvah present, to be honest. And it was a guitar that I asked for. And pretty quickly I started like making up songs because I was already super into creative writing and writing stories all the time. And I wrote poems. And so I started writing songs when I'm 14. I just was doing it all the time, and I liked performing them. I would go to lots of open mics, sometimes at bars, and my dad would have to take me, which he dutifully did. I like being better than like these adults playing John Lennon's Imagine really badly. That was fun for me. And I was like, oh, I'm not amazing, but like I'm better than that. Good feeling. And then I had like more serious musician. I don't know. I had friends in college who formed a band, and then they were like, you write good songs. Like, we should form a band with you. And then it kind of turned into a thing. I had like both ambition and also Midwestern, like, that'll never happen to me. Now, what am I special? I'm not special.
And I mean, the story's been told of your current, or let's say at a certain point in your career, you're wanting to make Judaism a more central part of your life. But I'm curious, in those early days, was it something that has always been part of your life in a serious way and it just became more so? Or was there a period where you drifted away from it and then came back to it?
So I grew up going to Solomon Schechter, conservative day school. My parents, however, were Reconstructionist Jews. They were like really into us being Jewish and knowing a lot about what it meant to be Jewish and how to be Jewish. And they also were kind of like, but it's all bullshit also, you know, like give me that little wink. even though we went to a Jewish day school, I feel like it wasn't expected for us to get that into it. And I got into it on my own, kind of in a different style than my parents. I had this older Orthodox friend, and I was like, he was very charismatic. He taught me all about like Orthodoxy, and I was like, I want to do this. And somebody handed me a compilation of Heschel writing, and I was like, this is like serious. So I was like, listening to punk rock and like reading Jack Kerouac and reading Abraham Joshua Heschel, and it was like the same thing to me. I was like, it was my nonconformist, like, I'm gonna be intense and serious. My friends are all just like going to the mall and gossiping, and I just hate it. And I want to take my life seriously. Punk rock and literature and Judaism was just one of those things, sort of. And then being Orthodox totally failed for me. I was like, oh, I can't do this. I really can't and maybe shouldn't do this. Mostly because I was queer. I wasn't out until I was like 18 as bisexual, I guess. And then I wasn't out as trans still. I don't even know when that. It was just all. I never really had a coming out moment with queerness. It was just a slow and sloppy, I'm telling some people this, appearing on stage in a dress here. And but yeah, that was a big ingredient of why Orthodox Judaism crashed. And also I was alone in it. I had 1 to 2 Orthodox friends and nobody was into it with me. I don't know. It's such a saga. And then I go to college and like, it's like, oh, I go to Hillel now. This is terrible. I hated Hillel when I went to college. It wasn't for me. It wasn't my scene. And I still had this love of like Judaism, and I believed in God, and I still believe in God, and I wanted to engage with like traditional Judaism. So I became Joy Ladin, I think, called it being a feral Jew. I just like made my own secret private bedroom Judaism, sort of. But I still had my family Passover Seders, and I didn't have nowhere to go, but I felt like I almost had nowhere to go. So after that period, Judaism dropped out of my life a little more in college and a little more after college. And then at some point, I was like, I need to keep Shabbat. It's just a very meaningful thing. And I had read Heschel on the Sabbath, and I just wanted to go back toward that. And then that became the thing. And I would, after a while, I was keeping Shabbat all the time, except when I was on tour with my band, because I was like, that's just impossible. And then I thought like, well, either I'm going to go toward Judaism or I'm going to go toward this music life and that kind of community and self-conception. And I had to choose between the two. And I was like, I think Judaism is going to win right now. I think that my band is not exactly a success, and it's really difficult to be in a touring band and not make money and have like 100 people worldwide interested in my music. So I was going to break up the band and stop going on tour, sort of, to so I could keep Shabbat again. And then my band and us, a couple other people I worked with, were like, I think we could just not play on Friday nights. I think we could get away with that.
I'm interested in many steps of this journey. I'm gonna shuttle us back,
please,
to your beautiful negative reaction to the folks playing Imagine at the bar for a couple reasons. Growing up, I knew the song Imagine by John Lennon. I thought it was a Jewish song. Like, true, like it was. I learned it at my Jewish summer camp. It was in the songbook. It probably said it was by John, like, but nobody reads the song. Like, you go to the page and then you like sing the song with can't. Like, I thought of it as a Jewish song, mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, let's live in peace and share the world. Like,
it's
this is a Jewish song. Like, sure, you're at a really interesting I don't know, intersection place on the like Jewish music front, right? Like there are people in the world who write, you know, in quotes, Jewish music, like the genre of their music, if you were to look it up, is like religion or like Jewish music. There are other people who, you know, write, who are Jewish, who write stuff that doesn't really strike people as necessarily Jewish music. You are creating music that clearly brings in spiritual Jewish, whether it's spiritual generally or occasionally specifically Jewish kinds of intentionality. And the end of your story could have been, and then I wrote an album of like liturgical Jewish stuff because I loved Shabbat. Like that could have been somebody's end to the story, right? But that's not where you went. And I'm curious, like, how do you approach some of those questions? You know, I'm sure you get asked all the time, is your music Jewish music? But how do you think about that duality that we've drawn, that choice that you kind of felt you had to make between, on the one hand, Jewish, on the other hand, or maybe on the one hand, Shabbat observance, on the other hand, touring with a band? How might we think a little more sophisticatedly about questions of spirituality, Judaism, and how they make their way into music?
Yeah, it's a good, it's just something that people ask me often, like, don't you want to be a cantor? You're like really into Judaism and really into music. Don't you want to be a cantor or be like a song leader? I'm like, no way, never, never. And I don't know why that is. And maybe that's a little, maybe I have like a hang up about that. I have been toying with the idea of actually using Jewish liturgy as the lyrics of my music. I have this desire that Judaism show up in the world. If you want to make it a dichotomy, like, does Judaism show up in the world and is seen in the world, or does the world show up in Judaism and is seen in Judaism? I tend toward this yearning for the former. I don't have the impulse to have Judaism be like welcoming in more influences from the outside. Not that I'm against that, but what's kind of special to me is when like Judaism stays itself in a big way, in a big recognizable way, and then shows up out in the world. I think that's why I incline to like not making sort of parochial music, but making music with a audience that is everybody, and just be very obviously Jewish sometimes. This spectrum is happening with me and queerness also. I have had these parallel coming outs about being queer and trans and also being into Judaism in a serious, in a God-believing way, in a way that holds tradition very dear in a lot of ways. And I just want everybody to be less assimilated and like inconveniently themselves in front of everybody with no embarrassment. Like that is just like, I almost feels like the project of my life. Keep the thing where you come from that is hard for other people to understand completely intact and just show it to the world. And the light that shines in your little parochial community, let it shine out for everybody to see. I'm sort of working on this thought that the thing that Judaism has to teach to the world is how to treat a minority in a larger community, a subgroup in a larger community, which might be the reason why a thing like don't oppress the stranger is reiterated over 30 times in the Bible. And what I'm hoping is true is that like we can just be ourselves and then show up in front of everybody acting like that, not toning anything down. And I think that applies to being Jewish and it applies to being queer in different ways. And it's not everybody's job to do that. I also hold dear like the closed door room a little bit. That's like some places are very Jewish and they're only supposed to be Jewish. I don't want to lock that door, but like, so that's all a lot of conceptual stuff that I think is sort of behind why I make kind of accessible pop music with Judaism in it rather than Jewish music with some rock and roll influence or something like that.
On the not sacrificing parts of ourselves, but instead showing the world the parts of ourselves, I want to float over to your new podcast, which, by the way, everybody listening, like, check out Ezra's podcast, Two Queers, Four Questions. As we record this, the most recent episode that you released was about a holiday that I think is a great example of, like, not assimilating, like showing up with the fullness of your quirky self in a world that doesn't get it. Because you talked about Shemini Atzeret. You talked about a holiday. And I think you started off the episode by saying, like, if you want to scare away a room of people, just, like, talk about Shemini Atzeret, this yeah. ridiculous holiday that's kind of its own, kind of part of the Festival of Sukkot. I'll let you talk about what it is. But, like, I bring it up because it's a great example of, like, it's not Hanukkah. It's not Passover. It's not, like, a holiday that sort of has made its way in certain senses into broader societal consciousness. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're not Jewish, the odds that you know what Shemini Atzeret are unbelievably low. And if you are Jewish,
it's still pretty low.
That you know what? Yeah, they're still really low. I don't think I can fake an answer to what a Shemini Atzeret, but it's still like a weird, like most rabbis just, they make up something for what it is because it's so amorphous.
Yeah.
But my favorite way that you described it on your podcast, or I don't know if it was you or Agnes, but it was that it was the eighth day of a 7-day holiday.
Yeah. The eighth day of a 7-day holiday.
So, talk to us. I mean, if you want to talk about Shemini Atzeret, you can. This episode is coming out a bunch after Shemini Atzeret. But I'm curious about that as an example of what you're describing. Of like, we have this set of, you know, raw materials in Judaism that the rest of society doesn't quite know what, like they don't know what they are. But like, what is it for you to like show up on a podcast and be like, hey everyone, take a look at Shemini Atzeret? How does that sort of continue the thread of what you were talking about before?
Well, the Shemini Atzeret episode might be my favorite episode so far that we've done. Just to introduce what the podcast is, we're going through the Jewish calendar and basically doing an episode about each Jewish holiday and writing our own four questions about that holiday in the tradition of the four questions of the Passover Seder. And I think the goal is to sort of uncover a vision of why Judaism might have seemed to overlap with punk rock, as I thought it did when I was a teenager, why it has countercultural potential. And Shemini Atzeret is just one of the least accessible Jewish holidays. It's hard to explain and nobody knows about it. It is also super joyful. I mean, Shemini Atzeret kind of combines with Simchat Torah, which is this explosion of joy all about the Torah, in which you dance with the Torah. And as I said in the episode, I have experiences of like doing a Simchat Torah celebration at a Chabad house in which we took the Torahs out in the street, drunk and like yelling in the street. And then we started going into bars, but just like dancing with the Torah and singing loudly in a bar full of non-Jews. Like, I just found it such a beautiful act. And I mean, that aura hangs over Sukkot too. It's a very weird holiday. If you've never heard of it, to see someone like shaking a lulav and etrog and building this outdoor hut, it's like, wow, that is different than most of life that I see in this city that I live in. I'm kind of with Abraham Joshua Heschel, who said that, I might get his phrasing wrong, the tragic failure of the modern mind or modern thought. Heschel grew up Hasidic in Europe, and then he went to go study philosophy in Berlin at a secular academy. And his conclusion was like, philosophy is a total failure to address anything that matters. And then the Holocaust happens, and he's like, we need an ancient voice. We need an influence of something, a whole different set of assumptions and values. And we should look back at this ancient stuff and take it really seriously. And that is huge in my conception of Judaism and why I'm into it. That it is like this ancient voice that contains thoughts I would never have on my own. And really sometimes really very helpfully pushes against things we just assume without thinking as modern and postmodern people. I think this podcast that we have, Two Queers, Four Questions, the way we're doing it is in that spirit very much, because it's just, it's me and my friend Agnes Borinsky, who's a playwright and artist and fiction writer with a sort of similar Jewish background to mine. She's also a trans woman, and we just don't care what anybody thinks about it. We're not trying to make it that good. We're not like cleaning it up or we're editing it. We are editing it, but not that much. And it doesn't sound that good. And it just feels like art that we're not cleaning up for public consumption. We're just like, this is what it is. Us talking about whatever we are into. Catch up with us or don't.
So I want to go back. You know, Lex, I thought you were going in a completely different direction with that question about Imagine. And because I was thinking about it too in the way that, like, Ezra, when you describe, you know, kind of that, those people in bars singing Imagine, like, it makes me think about Judaism in a certain way, like that there's some way in which a lot of people are doing a remake of this old song, which was great the first time that somebody sang it. And like, every time you sing it, it's just not as good. And yet, you know, you're not willing to make up your own song or something like that. And like, I thought that's where you were going, Lex. And like, I thought, and I was like excited. So I was still excited to talk about it. But I'm thinking about it now in connection to what you've been saying, Ezra. And I'm thinking, like, I'm so exhausted by the time Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah come along that even if I want to try to make something out of them, like, by the time I actually get there, I'm sort of too tired, or I'm too tired of the holidays, and I don't end up doing it. And it makes me think a little bit about, like, if we think that Imagine, the original, was the biblical holidays, like, in the biblical times, Sukkot was the holiday. Like, there was no Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, really, or to the extent that there might have been anything there.
It was just to be clear what you're getting at. It was called the holiday. Sukkot
the Talmud talks about it as Chag, which is the Hebrew version of Hajj. So it's really the pilgrimage holiday, right? But part of that was because there was no Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to kind of get people too exhausted. Rosh Hashanah probably didn't exist, and Yom Kippur, if anything, it was like the day where the priests were getting the temple ready for Sukkot. And the big holiday was Sukkot, and so for the regular people, they're like, oh, this is the big holiday. And then there's all kinds of, I mean, there's other joyous parts of Sukkot that we've almost completely forgotten, like the water drying libations festival, where there would be all this dancing and apparently hooking up and all kinds of things like that. And so, like, I'm thinking, though, then I think about the rabbis having kind of almost done a remake of the Jewish holidays, or of Imagine, right, where they added this whole, like, prelude with, like, really heavy guitars and, like, a full orchestra. And there's a piece of it where it's really cool on the one hand, like, that prelude that they wrote is really cool, but it actually ends up kind of diminishing the original that they have been trying to do a remake of. Like, it's sort of a cover of a cover of a cover of a cover. And then when I heard you talking, I was like, oh, so what? But what you're saying is what I've been trying to say, which is like, yeah, but there are certain things, like, if you really do dig into Shmini Atzeret, there is stuff in there that I never would have thought of on my own. So at the end of the day, I'm kind of asking you from an artistic perspective, like, how do you go about mining into this material? It's actually one of the reasons why I've been really excited about Marie Kondo and the whole idea of decluttering as part of this, because it's like, how do you dig into something really rich and amazing, but it's also kind of gotten cluttered and heavy, and how do you kind of simplify it and make it beautiful again?
What you're saying is contemporary Judaism is like a bunch of bad cover bands. I love the sentiment. Bad covers are just the bane of even good covers. Just doing covers is such a rough thing for people trying to make new music. The cover bands get booked and the original artists don't. It's a tricky question to ask. Like, if you want the energy of, like, punk rock, or even if you want the, like, if you want the energy of, like, Smashing Idols, you know, how do you do that if you're, like, sort of, you've venerated for generations the guy who smashed the idols, you know? Such that the idol smasher becomes the idol. Everyone keeps writing songs that are the same chord progression, you know? And I don't think that that's the problem. I think the problem is if you're doing that chord progression, Louie Louie or whatever, and it has no new thing of its own added to it. What you're trying to do is add your voice to this lineage. To me, it's not a problem to be doing what people have done before, because originality is kind of a myth. There's nothing new under the sun. You're not trying to do something that's never been done before. You're trying to be a person that's never existed before, I think. The question is not, what can I do that's new? That question is already solved. You are a new person that's never been around before, and we're in a new society, and the context is changed totally, regardless. So to celebrate an old holiday or to pray an old prayer, it's going to be new. The thing that makes it stale is if you're not bringing the newness of the moment and who you are to that prayer. Knowing your podcast, you might take issue with this, but I'm like, I don't hold up innovation so highly in Judaism. I hold up like feeling, saying the old thing in a new voice. Or you could say a new thing in a new voice, but I think we know as people who are interested in Judaism, something being old doesn't make it stale by itself. I've just sat through so much horribly stale rote Jewish moments. Who knows why some strike me that way and others don't.
So on this old and new front, ancient and today front, I do agree with you. Actually, I'm with you on basically not valuing innovation as innovation, like just because it's innovation. I think a lot about one building, and I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, the Old New Synagogue in Prague, the Altnoy, I'm actually not quite sure how to pronounce it, but like the Old New Synagogue. It's mm-hmm. where the golem was supposed to live. Everybody's big on golems lately. That's where the golem story is often associated with. But it was called the Old New Synagogue. And I think inherent to a lot of Jewish approaches is the idea that the old isn't permanently old based on when it was created. Like the old can become new, it can become revivified. There's ways in which ancient can become new, et cetera. And combining that with what you were saying before about how we need things that we would never think of in our own context. And your quote of Heschel and how in a world that is not achieving what we want it to, we actually need to look to like a different world, which is to say like a world from a few thousand years ago, say, and allow it to influence us. And so I do a lot of that. And the way that often works is that I find stuff that's super old in Jewish texts. And because nobody's really doing anything with them, if I then introduce them in a community, like they're new, right? Like, so you and I, Ezra, had a wonderful conversation about Shemitah. And on this podcast, the seventh year, the sabbatical year. And on this podcast, we've had a bunch of conversations about Shemitah. I would make the claim that in practice, Shemitah is new to most people. Like there are everybody I talk to pretty much. By the way, even like traditionalists, even people who grew up like Orthodox, like nobody's story is, yes, I grew up and in Sunday school or in my community, I was taught about Shemitah as a super big thing. Like it's new to people, even though it's not new, right? It's like thousands of years old. It's substantially older than any of our lifespans by orders of magnitude. But when you look to the ancient past and your goal is actually to find the stuff that will feel new because it hasn't been mobilized recently.
Yeah.
From my perspective, if you choose something that fewer people are used to or have a tradition of, then it's new to them and you have the potential to unlock something special, even if it's not really new. I'm curious if Shemitah or other kinds of specifics of ancient Jewish tradition feel of particular relevance to this conversation about old and new and how we can be creating forms of Judaism that don't feel rote, that instead feel inspiring.
Yeah, I think that you're right that some of the least familiar stuff has the most potential to be moving or transformative. because the stuff you know about, you've kind of domesticated it. Even if you find out new things about it, you've sort of, most people kind of won't change how they see Hanukkah or Passover that much because of the momentum of what they've been doing with it. But Shemitah, yes, new to like everybody. It has barely been observed by literally anyone. My mind doesn't first go to something like Shemitah, which is something, I think it's its own thing that has to be rewritten. If there's a Shemitah observance, we have to make it up, kind of. So it is, like you say, necessarily new. I always liked the intensity of Judaism, that it's asking me to do difficult things. I had this book about Lashon Hora, meaning the laws of proper speech and like gossip and how to not gossip about people or not say mean things about people. When I was 16 years old, I got this book. It was a distillation of the Chafetz Chaim, who I think is a 19th century rabbi. And I was obsessed with it. It was like, never gossip about anyone at all. And if you're at a table full of people who are talking badly about somebody, just get up and leave, or laws of like rebuking them. And then this whole system of how to figure out, maybe I do need to listen to this conversation because there might be useful information, but you're not supposed to believe it until you can verify it. And it's like legislating things that I hadn't thought possible to legislate, sort of, just like social conversational life. I just like the ambition of some of that stuff, the ambition that like, you could pay attention to everything in your life and be careful about things that you didn't ever give any thought. I think it's one of the great strengths of traditional Judaism that like transcendence infiltrates your whole everyday life. You've got words of Torah nailed to every doorway. You say a blessing every time you take a drink of water. It's not in a sanctuary where you go and have your ecstatic experience and then leave and go back to your non-spiritual life, but it is twisted through everything, this consciousness of God or consciousness of ethical imperatives all around us. And that being missing is the thing that dismays me most about a lot of Judaism, that it's just a thing on Saturdays. It's just so not ambitious, you know?
So I'm thinking about everything that you're saying, and I'm sort of connecting it to what you said earlier about sort of the experience of being a feral Jew, you know, somebody who's kind of out there having to make their own way. Like, sometimes I hear you talk about Judaism as if it is a fully formed thing that has a will, you know, that has an existence that says this is what it's doing. And other times I'm hearing you talk, you know, on the level of, you know, I've been a feral Jew, right? I've been someone who has had to take what I want to take, and other people are in that position, or you know, we've had this conversation about a variety of reasons why one might not fit into Judaism as it had evolved for the last 2,000 or 3,000 years, including being trans or whatever it might be, that says, well, there's obviously going to be things here that aren't going to fully match my experience because people like me weren't actively involved in the, you know, at least not in a outward way in the construction of this. And so how do I then sort of appreciate the wonders of this thing and the wonders even of the God who's behind it all, and at the same time have this degree of freedom or chutzpah to say, but I don't have to just enter into it as a cog into a machine. Like, it's a different way that I relate to that.
What Judaism is, in my formulation, is it's a tribe. It's not like a subcategory of society. It is a society of its own. It's a organizing structure, and I think it's organized. It has this constitution that is the Torah. I think if you consider yourself in the tribe in any way, if you feel affinity to Judaism, Judaism is yours to do stuff with. I'm a little allergic to over-venerating Jewish traditions. I love old things, like I said. I love old traditions and ancient mindsets. And also, I feel free to use them. I feel like the raw material of Judaism is mine to do whatever I want to do with. This is our assumption in our podcast. Me and Agnes are like people that the ancients never imagined. And yet we're inheritors of this tradition, this lineage, this literature. And to inherit something means that it's actually yours. I think of Judaism as like a place you can play. And to me, it's sort of the spiritual act of receiving the Torah is to actually take the Torah and know that it's mine to do whatever the hell I want to do with it. And you can use it in art, and you're not going to mess it up. You know, it's very sturdy. If you put it into a song, a poem, a podcast, there's no rules. It gets stale when it's a thing in a glass box.
What you're saying is like pulling me back in my own selfish autobiographical head, and I'm realizing some things. So you talked about how, for you, Judaism is mine. And by the way, for me, for Dan, like, it's not that it's just yours. It's, you know, each of us individually, it's mine, every mine that is part of this group. It's also, you know, ours as a collective. When you work in Jewish life, you tell your sort of Jewish journey story a lot of times, and sometimes you tell it differently. So I've like told the story about myself, and in some versions of my story of like how I became whatever it is that I am as a Jew, I talk about a moment where I first felt anything about a prayer. The prayer at the end of the Amidah, at the end of the central standing prayer, there's this thing, and it's called, it's Elohai Netzor, and it's the only prayer or one of the only prayers that is written in the first person. It's from a my voice, my God, comma, a bunch of things. It says, like, guard my tongue from evil. I thought of this because you were talking about evil speech, and it talks about guarding my tongue from evil speech. But the important thing, I actually, like, look, I read the English translation. This is like, oh, I actually care about that. I say bad things sometimes, and I'd like to not say bad things. And it's my takeaway wasn't, oh, will God protect my mouth from saying bad things? It was like, oh, I am interested in saying fewer crappy things to people. And wow, there's a prayer that actually says that. If I were to ask people, like, lay people, not folks who spend their lives thinking about Jewish stuff, like, is thinking about the words you say in life, like, is that sort of a Jewish thing? I think some people would say yes. I think some people say no. Like, mostly it's just like, that's just sort of a human thing, and people do that. If I were to ask, is this prayer, Elohai Netzor, a Jewish thing? They'd say yes. I think if somebody were to go up on a soapbox right now and give a speech about forgiving debts, and they didn't mention anything Jewish, they didn't mention like particular texts, I don't know that a passerby would know that's Jewish. But here we are in a year, Jewishly, where you forgive debts. Mm-hmm. But what I'm getting at is like the glass box piece you talked about before. I think there's a way in which we identify Judaism as like the set of things that have Jewish in their name or that are in Hebrew or whatever, and not the actual, like, we don't think that forgiving debts is the Jewish thing. We think Shemitah is the Jewish thing. And that's a huge problem, because that leads to this situation where, like, you have to parochialize in order for it to count, in quotes. And if you don't parochialize, if you just give the speech about how important it is to remit debts, then you're secular or you're, like, universalist. I find myself really sparked by you talking about how we can't deal with this Judaism within a glass box. We must shine it outward on the world. And I'm curious if what I just said, like, links with your thinking on that.
It does. It does a lot. Yeah, we want to stop short. I mean, some people are eager to say, like, Judaism invented something, like invented human dignity or something like that, you know? Judaism invented universal education. I don't know. Like, you can make little claims like that. But it's more, it's not even the claim. It's like the goal of making that claim is to be like, Judaism's so special and so important, and don't tell anybody, but we think it's better than anything else. And I hate that. Despite wanting to stay away from that kind of thinking, we can notice when things in our human lives that are arguably universal, like also are underlined and emphasized by Judaism. And I'm interested in how Judaism does that emphasizing, that motivating, that like any society visits the sick, right? But is there some Jewish, is there a thing about like, I am commanded to visit the sick and there are guidelines for how you visit the sick that will make you do it maybe more consistently or in a better way or just motivate you not to skip it for some reason? I mean, it gives cosmic proportions to these little acts that it's kind of reasonable to be like, it actually doesn't matter if I visit the sick person or not. You could argue it doesn't matter. And Judaism has this way of being like, no, that really, really matters. And religion in general does that. About the thing of like, Judaism is just the things that are in Hebrew or that have Jewish in front of them or something. This book that I read, which I realize in retrospect, represented almost a sort of turning point in my life, by Sylvie Simmons, called I'm Your Man. But it's the life of Leonard Cohen as a Jewish artist and the way, just to situate it in my life, I read this book when I was on those tours where I was like, I wish I could keep Shabbat, but we're touring and we got to play on Friday nights. And I don't know how long I can keep this up because Shabbat is becoming so important to me. And then I read this Leonard Cohen book, and Leonard Cohen is a guy who just seemed like he unified his life project. That's how it lands to me, that he did all this different stuff. He wrote some novels early on. He wrote lots of poetry. Then he became a songwriter. Then he became a very serious Buddhist. And the whole time he was Jewish, and at least in his music, was more and more Jewish as he got older, explicitly Jewish. I think I was very moved and inspired by the way that he was just like, yes, everything goes in and it's all one life project. You don't have to choose between music and Judaism. There's, why would you choose? You know, just be for real and do the things that matter to you. And I think it was this process of admitting that all this incongruous stuff all matters to me and also can all go into the same life. And I feel the same way about the Jewish content of everyday life. Like, this stuff should all mix together, and none of it has to be sidelined or diluted. Leonard Cohen never stopped being a poet. He didn't stop being a Jew when he became a Buddhist. Just a soulful person, you know? I want to be like that, and I want it to be possible to do Judaism that way.
Thank you so much, Ezra, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Love talking to you guys about this stuff.
Us too. This was such a pleasure. Thank you, Ezra. Thank you, all of you out there, for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. As we close out, we of course want to encourage you to check out Ezra's new podcast, Two Queers, Four Questions, which you can check out in Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all the places that you can find podcasts. And also check out all of Ezra's music. She has some really amazing stuff out there. We hope that you will listen in. And of course, to close out on our end, we encourage you to be in touch with us with any questions or thoughts that you have about this episode or any other recent episodes. And you can be in touch in all of the following ways. First, there are our Facebook and Twitter and Instagram feeds. All of those are Judaism Unbound. Second, there's our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. We also would love to request, for those of you who are able, to send us some support financially or otherwise. The financial way is that you can head to judaismunbound.com/donate. Some of the other ways that you can give us a review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. All of that is super helpful. And the final note is that support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.